Well, hey, it's time for Ask the Tech Guys. I'm Leo Laporte. Coming up, an update to my 6 rules of computer security.
And I'm Micah Sargent, and we help someone who's traveling internationally close those Apple Watch rings.
Then a librarian calls in to give us some great tips on using Google Search. Ask the Tech Guys is next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Ask the Tech Guys with Micah Sargent and Leo Laporte, episode 1982 for Sunday, July 9th, 2023. Traffic cone confusion. This episode of Ask the Tech Guys is brought to you by Miro. Miro is your team's online workspace to connect, collaborate, and create together. Tap into a way to map processes, systems, and plans with the whole team. Get your first 3 boards for free to start creating your best work yet at Miro.com/podcast. Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support. Well, hey, how are you today? It's time for Ask the Tech Guys.
Hi, Leo Laporte.
I'm Michael Sargent.
How are you today?
I'm very well. Did you get on, I know you did, this is a rhetorical question, the hottest thing going, the biggest tech launch in years, it's the new Threads from Meta.
Yeah, it's I don't even know if it's fair to call it a launch. It's sort of like a hopping over or a it, there's something
the,
there.
The because, hottest hopover.
Yeah,
in
the hottest hopover. Because that's the thing about this is if you've got an Instagram account, you've basically got everything you need to join Threads.
In fact, so, you can't really you can't change it, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be your Threads account, which in my case is TWiT Leo. What are you?
I am Micah Sargent, as always.
But you might say it looks a little bit like something. In fact, so much like it that Elon Musk has threatened to sue for stealing Twitter's look and feel.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to get away with that.
Steal Twitter's look and feel, and also make use of the Twitter employees that they hired.
Which they didn't.
Yeah, they didn't work on this.
So a lot of people... before this launch, there was a lot of concern in Mastodon. A lot of Mastodon admins said, we'll never have anything to do with this. I saw a lot of articles about the privacy issues with this because it's Meta. It has the same privacy settings as Instagram and Facebook app. So it's no different in that regard. But it potentially could collect your health information, whether you're pregnant. They don't have any ads yet.
Right. In fact, Zuckerberg said on the service that just like Facebook, we are going to try to build this up first. And then once we get there, then we'll get you. Then we'll get exactly.
But Zuck also said yesterday, 70 million users already.
Mm-hmm.
It is the single fastest launch of any app ever in history.
Wow.
And it's because A, it's very easy, but B, the timing couldn't have been better.
Truly. Twitter is at its, we've seen this a number of times, but for us being in this sort of group that we're in as sort of techie journalist, Twitter lover area, we may have seen that Twitter was, oh, it's so bad. It's this, it's that, up to this point. And we made that jump,
but there was nowhere really to go.
And also it still did not impact the everyday people.
Right.
Now the everyday people are also getting to a place where they want to go elsewhere and try the new hotness. And Threads did a good job of making itself the new hotness.
Here's the data linked to you health notice on the iPhone. The following data may be collected and linked to your identity, health and fitness, financial info, contact info, user content, browsing history, usage data, diagnostics, purchases, location, context, search history, identifiers, sensitive info, and other data.
Yeah.
Basically everything.
which is why you should be very mindful of what accept buttons you hit upon, you know, creating your Threads account, and also be mindful of what you have on Instagram. So I always recommend people go in, check up on their privacy, check up on what they've given permission for in these apps. But at the same time, a lot of this is not necessarily directly the app just digging into the health app and pulling that from there. It's instead the idea that this information can be garnered based on what you're posting, what you're interacting with, that kind of thing.
If you're on Android, if you have the choice to use it on Android, because they have a more granular privacy settings, you could turn stuff off. And I'm told that it doesn't necessarily break the app if you turn off some of these things. It didn't stop anybody.
No.
Even people like me who said, I will never use Facebook, but it's Instagram. What could be? But what's really interesting, because so many people have instantly joined it, including celebrities, mm-hmm. brands, NPR, which famously left Twitter because Elon said they're a government-funded entity, joined immediately. Everybody joined immediately. So suddenly it feels like Twitter.
Yes, there were so many people there. And that, I think, has been one of the big issues with other social media services, is that even if you enjoyed this sort of I'm in an exclusive club feel, you didn't necessarily have that. I mean, what does this all boil down to? It boils down to wanting to feel seen, wanting to feel heard. And frankly, the sort of dopamine cycle that we get whenever people are interacting with us. And that is happening on this platform in a way for some people that it hasn't even happened on Twitter. I think that's one of the wildest things to me is, I know a few people who have been on Twitter for a long time. They've got maybe 12 followers or, 30, whatever, and don't get much play. But because this was all day one or week one, they're getting so much attention there. And that is sort of amping them up to continue to use this.
Well,
so,
there's another reason. Mm-hmm. I don't know if people are aware of this or not. So Twitter is a follow thing, right? They do have that For You tab where it's suggested stuff. TikTok, same thing, mm-hmm. but most people just look at the For You feed, or I can't remember what they call it.
It is For You on TikTok, yeah.
It's not people you followed. It's algorithmic. And Threads has decided to go with that model feed. So the minute you join Threads, it doesn't matter if you followed anybody. Mm-hmm. You will see all the things that Threads wants you to see, which makes it very easy to discover stuff you want to follow. And they make it even easier to follow because there's a little plus button
right
on the
head. On the main page. Yep.
So I think in some ways Meta has learned from Twitter and has decided to go with the algorithmic feed. Now, there are a lot of people on Threads saying we want the chronological feed. We want the followers feed. And Adam Mosseri, who runs Instagram and is running Threads, says that's coming. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really smart to start this way because it gets all of the velocity of something like TikTok. When you go to TikTok, you don't have to have followed anybody. You instantly see content that, you know, is compelling, because the algorithm is choosing it for you. And Threads is exactly the same. So that's one thing they did that was very smart. They have promised, mm-hmm. and I'm very interested to see if the promise comes through. They have promised many, many new features. This is the first edition, right?
Right.
Although, because it's Meta, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a former Meta engineer, and I said, the stack, it's incredibly responsive. There's no fail whale. Everything works smoothly, fluidly, so much so that you're not even conscious of it.
That's true.
It just
I
works.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's Meta. They know how to do this. They know how to. Their network stack is the best in the business. That's one advantage. But they may or may not. They promise to make some additions to this. So I say this because it's a first generation app, but it's very mature. It's very polished. But there's lots of missing features. For instance, there's no direct messaging. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're going to bring that, and I don't know if they should. There is quote tweeting where you can say, I like that post that Micah just did, retweet it with my comment, by the way, we don't have a word for threads. And some people have suggested just call it tweets, which must drive Elon crazy.
I disagree with that so much. It doesn't matter that it's Twitter. No, it's just, why would you call? I'm just going with posts.
We'll
right
go
now.
With posts. That's generic.
Although I'm John sure Slonina suggested thimbles, which I thought was hilarious.
Because it's threads, right?
Yeah.
Or skeins, or I don't know.
Stitches.
Stitches isn't bad. I want a stitch. Anyway, there are a few things they really do need to add. One is that followers feed. One is a chronological feed, because you'll see stuff from all over, from all kinds of people. For early adoption, though, there's nothing better. And that's why 70 million people are going, yeah, this is great. I love it. It's like, I feel like I'm at home already.
Right.
It also, if you let it, and most people will, it immediately copies your Instagram followers and followings over.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nice because you already have friends, right?
Yeah, because that's one of the most one of the most difficult things with a new social media service is you are presented with a page. It's like, here are some people you might want to follow. And it's always no one I want to actually follow.
Yeah.
So I liked that this was, okay, these are people who I've been following and interacting with for a long time. But then we're also seeing this extra
stuff.
You
do have some control over it if you go to the settings, which is hard to find. And threads and replies. You can change it a little bit. Again, they've made promises. The biggest promise from my point of view that I'll be very surprised if they follow through on is to federate. Now, maybe because they made this so publicly, promised so publicly, maybe they will go ahead and do it. But what that means is if you're on, say, Twit Social, which is our Mastodon server, or Mastodon.social, or some other Fediverse, Pleroma or Kalki or Miski or one of the other Fediverse sites, you could follow somebody on Threads. So all I need to know is it's at Micah at threads.net. Add that to my Twit Social. Now everything you post on Threads, I'm seeing without seeing any of the other stuff. And similarly, if they do this the way it's supposed to be done, you could follow at Leo at twit.social on your Threads account.
Threads, right.
This would be, and now a lot of Mastodon people are saying, oh, ew, yick, no. But it doesn't give Meta any data.
Right.
It ActivityPub doesn't leak data. So you're not giving them anything, you're getting. So all those brands that have never joined Mastodon, all those people who say, oh, it's too hard, I don't like it, it's too geeky, suddenly, if they do this, will be available to Mastodon users, which will make Mastodon and the Fediverse much more vital and exciting. It won't overwhelm it. It'll just make it better.
The conversation that I saw always seemed to be this sort of exclusivity thing. You can't sit with us. It was this idea that the people who would be joining Threads are the people you wouldn't want around you anyway.
Well, then you don't follow them.
Exactly. That's how I feel about it, too.
You don't follow them. All this does is gives you a big universe that you can dip your toe into without contaminating your entire body.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be good. Now, the reason I'm skeptical that they'll do it at this point is they don't need to. And all it does is it makes it easy for you to not be on Threads and get much of the value of Threads.
Because you wouldn't have to use the app.
Right.
And that's where they're going to be getting that data eventually.
If you look at the Mastodon privacy, zero.
Mm-hmm.
No data. So there are a lot of people who are privacy focused or people who want more control over it, who don't want an algorithmic feed, who want to be able to follow Micah, but don't want to go into the Threads world, will suddenly have that option. Now, you are posting a lot on Threads, I noticed.
Yes, right now I am. I kind of do that with every new social media service.
Yeah,
that starts
just to try
up.
It out.
Yeah, just to give it a go.
It does pictures very nicely.
It does. Pro tip for anybody out there who's running the beta and you are using Threads, you cannot post photos the normal way because of bugs. So you just so you know, if you're out there, copy and paste the photo.
Oh,
that's how you do it to make it work.
It does, I think, such a nice job with photos that it's kind of like Instagram meets Twitter.
Yeah, that's what people I've seen almost more than
and
anything else.
Too,
that's the comment.
Yeah.
Is that they like how the photos are laid out. They like how easy it is. My one problem that they should hop on is that you can't do image descriptions on these photos, and they need to add that feature in.
Mastodon folks will not like that. There are no content warnings either. There's a, you know, there's a somewhat of a mismatch in culture.
Definitely.
Nevertheless, the fact that you could pick, you know, the top 20 people that you want to follow or brands who are not on the Fediverse is going to be great. I hope that they follow through. I feel like they've made a commitment. However, Threads is great. And Elon is terrified. That's why he's suing and or threatening to sue. I don't know if he's actually filed suit. I think this is going to be very interesting because a lot of people, myself included, have said, yeah, it's the end of social. Social media is dead. Nobody wants social media. It's a failed system. Mm-hmm. But there's a certain value, I think, to having your finger on the pulse of the world and what's going on. That's what we use Twitter for.
Yes. And this is just the other day on Tech News Weekly. My story of the week was about the death of Google Reader. And what became clear to me from going through this.
Which, by the way, happened to a long time, 10 years ago.
10 years ago. Yeah. So it's the anniversary of the death.
There's a great article about it. And yeah, I'm sure that's what you talked about.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in it, they talk about how leading up to that point, there was not really a way for people to know what websites and articles were out there. And you'd go to your favorite websites and refresh the page over and over again. But what Google Reader did was it brought in all of that content from all of those other places. And in the piece, they talk about how leading up to that point, there was nothing like Twitter or, you know, these things were getting off the ground. And so you didn't have people sharing content regularly. And I find that that is where social media is most valuable, when folks are sharing stuff that I wouldn't find any other way. And being able to see what people who I find interesting or who I care about, what they care about, what they find interesting, that's the value for me. And so in that way, I don't want social media to go away because I want to be able to have access to all of the stuff that people think is cool.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things that's happening on Threads. There was a movement, you know, one of the very important sections of Twitter was a community on Twitter called Black Twitter. Mm-hmm. And had not been replicated really on Mastodon, or they didn't, a lot of Black people didn't feel welcome on Mastodon. And so there was a new Twitter clone called Spill, as in spill the tea, which yes. I think is a great name. And it was just getting started, but I notice almost everybody that I followed on Black Twitter has moved to Threads. Mm-hmm. So I think they will probably, Black Lives Matter is there. I think they will probably recreate much of the Twitter experience. I think the algorithmic feed is done much better than Twitter's For You feed. Instead of bringing up a lot of stuff you really don't want to see, it's like TikTok. It does a very good job of surfacing stuff and people that I want to follow. I feel like at this point I've followed 300 people on Threads that I have pretty much the same group that I had on Twitter that I'm following. So I find this fascinating. I really do. We haven't seen a launch like this in a long time.
No, it's been exciting. And what I also find fascinating is how quickly folks are almost trying to set up these flags, these sort of agreements, trying to sort of define the culture that's taking place there. But what always
As
seems
always,
to happen,
there's
yes,
always people who
it
say
changes over time. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So we'll see. We'll keep an eye on how this changes over time.
You know, I hate to give Mark Zuckerberg any credit, but you got to when he does deserve it. And this is, you know, the thing I've been mad about for a long time with Meta is they've just copied whatever's the hot thing.
Yeah.
When Snapchat was hot, they put reels on Instagram. I mean, they, you know, they've really just copied dozens of other successful efforts. This is the first time it's worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful because Twitter was a valuable resource. Elon, I think, has really destroyed it, and I'm glad to see it's back. I don't have a blue check on Threads because I didn't have a blue check on Insta.
Yeah. What's annoying is I once did, and then
I don't even understand
deleting all of
works.
My Facebook
I don't really
stuff.
Care.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm just really glad to see that something's happening. We've been kind of gridlocked for a while in technology, so it's fun, always fun to see when something kind of wow, get some traction.
Yep.
Reminds me of the good old days, you know, of South by Southwest. If you want to ask a question, make a comment, make a suggestion, the best way to do it right now is use the phone, 888-724-2884. And if the lines are open all the time, if you call when we're not on the air, which is 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern, you will be able to leave a message. We have some voicemail messages. But if you call on Sunday, 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern, we'll be here.
We will.
We'll put you in a special room. You can hear what's going on. And then when we pick you up, press *6 to unmute and say who you are, first name and city. You can also use Zoom, call.twit.tv. We have quite a few Zoomers ready to get on the show. I see your hands raised. And of course, if you can't get through or you want to do it when we're not on the air, you can always email atg@twit.tv. We love the audio recordings. Send us video recordings too, though. We love the videos. Should we take our first call here?
Let's take our first call.
Let's go to Sean, who is on Zoom and has his hand raised. Hello, Sean. Welcome to the ATG Stargate.
Howdy.
Hey.
Howdy.
Where are you calling from?
Hi, guys. I'm calling Sean from Buena Park.
Nice to see you. And a very nice picture. You must be a podcaster with that microphone.
No, but I do spend a lot of time on Zoom for work, for sure.
Yeah, nowadays, everybody, right?
Yeah, I like that you've got a shirt that's saying, mute your microphone. You're on mute.
Yeah.
The number one for us, statement.
Us Zoomers, that's the most common phrase that
absolutely.
We use, right?
That's hysterical. Do you Zoom for work?
Yeah, I imagine you guys have been in my neighborhood before. I'm right by Knott's Berry Farm. So.
Oh, Knott's Berry Farms. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right down the street.
That's a great place. That's where Steve Martin got his start.
Yeah.
In the Wild West.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, they have that I don't know, sort of weird Wild West review at Knott's Berry Farm. And he started there. He tells the story in his Born Standing Up books.
I'm going to have to listen to that. I'm a huge Knott's Berry Farm fan. Grew up in the area. Went there, you know, my whole life. But that's a story that missed me.
So he has some great anecdotes about it. We love Knott's Berry Farm, too. I've been there many times. So what can we do for you, Sean?
So my father-in-law passed not too long ago. And during the process of cleaning out his garage, we found a box of old photos, like a lot of folks do, photos and videos. And we wanted to memorialize that. So what we did was gathered all those up and looked for the process to scan those in. And being a little bit with a tech background, I had done that before, where I had purchased a scanner and used the scanner software to do the process. But we had over 1,000 pictures, and I knew that would take some time. And then I also had used the photo scan from Google, and that's a great tool, one at a time for pictures, but wasn't going to solve this very large number that I wanted to scan. I looked into some third parties to do it, and a little price prohibitive. And I thought, hey, you know what? I could probably just take this on as a project and do it. Then realized I have a high-speed scanner at work. So I took it to work with one of the very nice Xerox scanners. And man, it worked like a charm. Just scanned all those photos in, you know, 1 second and did the whole process. However, this is where my question comes in. What I ended up with wasn't exactly with what I was hoping. Mm-hmm. I ended up with a photo that was cropped in one direction, but not the opposite direction. Oh. So now I have 1,000 photos that need to be cropped and rotated. And I'm wondering if there's any automated process or software out there that would allow for that to, you know, aid in, like, especially with AI these days, any technology that would help with that.
Oh, absolutely. Are you on a Mac or Windows?
Windows.
Too bad, because actually Apple ships with a command line tool that will do this in a batch mode.
Weird my daughter thing. My daughter has an Apple, so I could certainly use her machine to do this.
So, and there are many, many, many command line tools that would do this. You mentioned AI, though. That's kind of interesting. Do you feel like it could be done exactly the same way on each image?
No, because the way they scanned in, it was there are different sizes and the crops are different. So, you know, groupings of them could be done similarly, but not all the same.
So you want a tool that will say, here's the heads.
Yeah. Or like, here's the corners of the photo.
Corners of the photo would be ideal. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And, you know, optimally rotate, you know, but that would take some sort of AI to look at it and say, oh, which is the proper orientation. And I don't know that that's out there yet. I'm sure it will be soon with all these AI tools that are popping up. But I just haven't been able to find something to solve this problem.
So you want a way to, and you'd ideally like to have it batch mode so that you say, here's 1,000 photos, fix them.
Exactly. Exactly. Them. So, you know, I could do it one at a time, but it'll take me months.
Yeah. There are a number of tools that will do this. And I'm just thinking about the batch mode thing, which is often a command line thing. This is something I just found just now from Vance AI, vanceai.com. It's called the Cropper. and it'll do this online. You could at least try and see if it does what you want it to do.
Okay.
It seems like it has some AI. Scooter X has just given us something called Fotor, F-O-T-O-R. Let me go to a Fotor.com because it does batches, which would, you know, that's the ideal, right? I mean, obviously you'd want to run it a couple of times with one or two images to make sure it's doing the right thing.
For sure. Yep.
Yeah. This has an AI image generator in it. It's an online photo editor. Lets you edit photos in just a few clicks. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's the problem here is the sort of smart portion of that.
Yeah, you want it to like know where the heads are.
Right? Yeah, oh,
that's true. Yeah, Photoshop.
Can I share a picture? Yeah, I don't know if you guys have the capability.
Share it.
Let me share. I'll give you an example of what one looks like.
Yeah, we're on regular Zoom. Anything you can do in your Zoom room.
There you go.
Okay.
So, yeah, and you can see the actual crop is the gray on either side of the photo itself.
So that's stuff that's missing, or does it get the whole photo?
It gets the that is the whole photo.
I see.
The gray boxes on either side are where the crop didn't happen, and then the white is not really part of the photo.
So the scanner you used was smart about saying this is what we want, but it did so. Yeah. It got the whole image. But it, but it just didn't.
It didn't crop on both sides.
It didn't crop on both sides. Exactly. It did one side only.
Here's one called Cloudinary AI based image auto crop algorithm sticks to the subject. So, but you don't want to cut the photo, right? You want the photo to persist. You just want it to be put. Rotated so it's 6 whatever it is 5x4 or whatever size you want without the borders. That's a little different than this AI stuff because it doesn't have to understand the content.
Right. It just needs to know.
Normally when a scanner, my experience has been when a scanner, and so have you scanned them all already? You have.
I did, but you know, I can always go back and do it again. It wasn't that big of a process.
Normally a scanner has automatic image recognition. Where it'll know which part of the scan has content, which doesn't, and will then appropriately fill the page. So I'm wondering, there may be a setting in your scanner that you missed that would produce a scan, which is what you want, the full size. Now, it won't be rotated because it's not content aware, but that would be easy. There's a million tools that will take a 4x5 and turn it to a 5x4. That's a simple thing to do. What you really want to do is get rid of those blank borders.
You have the letterbox on either side.
I think the scanner should have done that automatically.
I agree. It is odd that it didn't.
I dug through the menus and I got it to do this. Originally, it would just scan with the full 8.5x11. Right. And then I said, oh, no, there's got to be something better. So I found the crop settings that basically say, oh, no, crop it to the size of the photo. And this is what it ended up doing.
What's the brand of scanner? Others
I can look.
What's this brand of scanner?
It's a Xerox. It's one of the, you know.
Do you know the model number?
It's an 8830.
So the reason I ask is we can crowdsource some of this manual scanning. I don't have ChatGPT-4 here, but we do have a much smarter chat room. And our Discord. Mm-hmm. And I bet you some of them are going to go look up the scanner and see if there is a setting. Because, see, consumer scanners, you'll put four images on there and it will say, oh, yeah, I see four images. I'm going to give you four scans properly cropped.
Yep.
Paper size.
And that's how I did it previously.
Yeah. And are all the images the same size?
No, they're all varying size. I mean, you know. A couple hundred at the standard sizes and then a few larger ones, you know.
Yeah. 4x6.
Yeah, exactly. All the standard 10. Photo sizes, but they're not all the same.
That's why you need this. See, and that's the thing is when I scan something on a slower scanner, it has that edge detection. It knows where the paper is and then can crop it to that. But for some reason, it only was cropping along one side.
Our chat room says that this is because it's a document scanner.
It is a document
scanner. It's specifically for scanning 8x10.
So it's looking for a longer piece of paper.
So it's not going to say, it's not going to say, It's very fast. So wow.
Oh, it's great. It was just lightning through all of them, very quick.
I think what you should do is I think you should email me at iostoday@twit.tv.
Boy, because you're brave.
If you do that, what's going to happen is I'm going to remember this. I'm going to ask my co-host, Rosemary Orchard, who is a shortcuts expert, who probably knows about a lot of a smart tools that could then do this edge detection. So because I will forget if you don't do that email, please email. Because yeah, then I can ask Rosemary. She's probably got a few ideas for how to do this edge detection. They may be just built in, but if they're not, sometimes there are some tools that people have created. Because there's this set of tools called Image Magic. That's M-A-G-I-C-K. That's an open source software suite.
A lot of people use that, and they would do a lot of the things that you want to do.
And they do talk about edge detection there. Yeah. So yeah. It feels like this might be a question we won't be able to answer here in the short term, but I want to run this by Rosemary and see if she has some ideas.
Let me find the Mac image, the command line image tool, because I can't remember the name of this. I want to say S. It begins with S, I think, but I haven't ever used it. Most people use Image Magic. That's on Mac, Windows, and Linux, and it's a very powerful tool. Is it FIM? I don't know off the top of my head. I've been collecting Mac terminal commands.
Yeah, I think you might have been in that.
I sent it to you. I did send it to you.
It is.
And I just don't remember the.
SIPS, S-I-P-S.
It is S-I-P-S. Okay. I thought it began with an S. So SIPS, and you could do, man SIPS or SIPS -help, and it will give you the commands. It's designed for batch modifying things. So one thing you could do is sort your photos into the 6x4s and the different sizes. That's easy to do. You just stack them, right? Sort them out and then scan each batch separately. And then since you know now this whole batch has these borders, you could use SIPS to then trim those off or Image Magic or any of those things. So that's the manual way of doing it.
Yeah. So still email me because we may have an automated thing that Rosemary has an idea.
The only manual part is just scanning the images, all the like images at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Very generous, Micah. Thank you. I really appreciate the offer, and I'll take you up on that.
Good question.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Awesome. I have one follow-up to what you guys were talking about offline when the show started. Tech guy most of my life, and did a lot of social media early on, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and really kind of fell away from that over the many years. Maybe a year ago, my daughter sent me a video on this thing called TikTok. And I'm pretty much a junkie now, so I need to figure out a way to disconnect from that. Oh my gosh. I am just so obsessed.
Are you losing sleep? You're not really a TikTok junkie till you actually lose sleep.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'll spend the last 15 minutes, what I think is going to be 15 minutes of the night, getting caught up on what the latest TikToks are. 3 hours later, I'm exhausted and trying to drag myself to bed.
You've got to use screen time.
I put it on. It didn't help. Oh. It just tells me.
All right. I'll give you one tip. Off. Because one thing both Android and Mac will, or iOS will do is turn at after a certain time, like 10 p.m., make everything black and white.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I have to say, it still works, but it's just not as compelling. Yeah.
All right. All right. That will be my step one of, I think, a multi-step process.
Yeah. And to detox. The first step is to admit you have a problem. So you're getting there.
The third step is to buy one of those internet connected wristbands that zaps you. And so after an hour on TikTok, it'll zzz.
I just think my tolerance for pain would build up over time.
That's what's going to happen.
Isn't that amazing?
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for the laugh.
This is how TikTok did it well.
They did well.
And it's kind of why I'm bothered by this whole desire to ban TikTok, because there's such useful, great content on there. And they did it right. And obviously Meta learned.
Yes.
And I think Threads is going to be the next TikTok. I honestly do. Let's take a little break, and we're going to come back with more. Do we have anybody on the show today, or is it just us?
We do.
Sam Abel, yeah. Sam at Car Guy coming up. Oh, that's exciting. He'll be here in about an hour. But first, a word from
he's
our sponsor.
Here, so yeah, we'll take.
Oh, he's here now.
Yeah, so we'll take an ad break.
Holy
we'll
cow!
Head to Sam.
It's like Beetlejuice. I said his name once, though. All right. Okay. He has appeared. We will get to Sam Abel, Sam to talk cars in a bit. But first, a word from Miro. Quick question for you. If you have a team and you're creating new products, new ideas, marketing, are you struggling a little bit with the multiple tools you have to use, going from tab to tab, tool to tool? You know why the struggle happens? It's called the context switch. It's the same reason why you forget what you were going into the next room for as soon as you go through the door frame. There's something about the human brain. Losing brilliant ideas and important information as you switch from tool to tool is normal. That's why you need Miro, M-I-R-O. Miro's one tool that does it all, a collaborative visual platform that brings all your great work together no matter where you are. You could be working from home in a hybrid workspace. You can be on Zoom. In fact, you'll love it with the video calls on Zoom or Teams or whatever you use because they have a timer, they have icebreakers. It's a great way to brainstorm. When you first look at it, and don't be fooled by this. It might look like a simple digital whiteboard. Oh, no, no. Oh, my friend, no. Miro's capabilities go far beyond that. It really is a visual collaboration tool packed with features for the whole team to build on each other's ideas and build the future. You can shorten your time to launch so customers get what they want faster. With Miro, you need only one tool to see your vision come to life for planning, for researching, brainstorming, designing, feedback cycles. It can all live on a Miro board across teams. And what's nice is there's a single source of truth for the whole team, for everybody. So there's no question. This is it. This is what we're working on. And by the way, it's fast and easy to use, and faster input means faster outcomes. Miro users report that Miro will increase their project delivery speed by 29%. You can view and share the big picture overview in a cinch. And when everyone has a voice, and everyone can tap into a single source of truth, it's great for the team. They stay engaged. They're invested. They're heard. And they're happy. Cut out any confusion on who needs to do what by mapping out processes, roles, and timelines. You do that with several templates, including Miro's swim lane diagram. Go look at the Miroverse for some ideas. Strategic planning becomes easier when it's visual and accessible. Tap into a way to map processes and systems and plans with the whole team so they not only see it, but they have a chance to get engaged, to give feedback, to be part of the process. And I got to tell you, who isn't feeling meeting fatigue, right? Miro users report saving up to 80 hours per user per year. That's like a 2-week vacation every year just from streamlining those conversations and feedback. No wonder a million people use Miro every single month. You should too. Get your first 3 boards for free. That makes it really easy to try. Work better together. Miro.com/podcast. Miro.com/podcast. Please use that address so they know you saw it here. First 3 boards free. So you can really get your teeth into it and see what Miro can do for you. We've been using it. It's just fantastic. Miro, Miro.com/podcast. All right, Micah.
It's time.
It's time to say hello to Car Guy, Sam Abul Samad, principal researcher at Guy House Insights. He is also the host of the fabulous Wheel Bearings podcast. We had a Wheel Bearings takeover on Twitter a few weeks ago. It was so much fun.
Great episode.
With Nicole and Robbie. Hello, Sam.
Hello, Leo and Micah. How are you guys doing today?
You're sitting in front of one of the cars I've been considering for my next vehicle.
Sincere?
The VW ID Buzz?
Yeah.
It's really cute.
It's like a VW van updated. It's electric.
I kind of like it.
It is, yeah. That is the ID Buzz, which was first shown as a concept, I'll say back in 2018, maybe 17. It was quite a while. I was at the reveal at the Detroit Auto Show back then. Yeah, it was like 5 or 6 years ago. And they finally launched a production version of the ID Buzz in Europe last year.
Is it coming to America?
It is coming to America. There's 2 versions of it. There's the one that's in the picture behind me is the short wheelbase
version.
It's
so cute. It looks like a little
which
honeycomb.
Is a 2-row, so it's a 5-seater.
This is what Jammer then, B wants to go to Red Rocks to see Humphreys McGee in. No, he wants the lawn camper. Is there a camper van version?
That is coming. Wow. So what we're getting here in North America is a little bit longer version with three rows of seats. So it'll seat seven or eight, I think. And that's coming first half of next year. They recently unveiled that version at an event in Santa Monica about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Oh, so cool.
But the reason why I have this one up here, this is actually the short wheelbase version. So this is the version that's on sale now in Europe, is this one is one you won't be able to buy unless you happen to own a very large fleet, because this one is fully automated. This is a robo-taxi, a prototype robo-taxi. Volkswagen had originally started working on this program a couple of years ago with Argo AI, which was a company that was founded with funding from Ford, and then eventually VW invested in it. And so they were working on this with Argo. They've had them had automated versions of this testing in Munich and Hamburg, and I think maybe Hanover, since sometime early in 2022 or maybe late 2021. Unfortunately, for a lot of reasons I'm not going to go into today, Argo was shut down last fall. So Volkswagen had to come up with an alternate plan. And so they switched their allegiance over to an Israeli company called Mobileye, which is majority owned, was until relatively recently fully owned by Intel. Intel still owns about 94-93% of the shares in Mobileye. They did an IPO last year. But Mobileye has been developing their own automated driving system. And after the shutdown of Argo, VW opted to work with Mobileye on this program. And this past week, they announced that the first batch of 10 of these 10 of these ID buzzes equipped with the Mobileye automated driving system are now testing in Austin, Texas.
Huh.
So they're not just in Germany. They're here in the U.S. in Austin. And they're going to be testing these. I think they're currently still doing some mapping and some initial testing, but they're going to be testing these over the next couple of years in Austin, where there are already there's already a commercial robo taxi service running that I can't remember if we talked about it here on the show or not, with Cruise.
You and Nicole took a ride in the Cruise, didn't you?
We did. Yeah. And had a few issues.
Wasn't ideal, was it?
Yeah. So there's a video that's on the Wheel Bearings YouTube channel that you can see, where we shot a video during our ride. And if you go there, you can find that.
My friend Charlie lives in Bernal Heights in San Francisco, and he says that, for a while, it was just jammed with Cruise vehicles. He thought they were sending him up there for testing because it's very hard to drive up there, very narrow streets. He says it's stopped. But San Francisco residents who have been inundated between Waymo and Cruise with these self-driving vehicles are getting a little bit unhappy about
annoyed.
Them. Annoyed. Yeah. The Verge said that some of them are putting out orange traffic cones to thwart them.
Yeah, basically turning them into unicorns, sticking a traffic cone sensors on the hood of the Chevy Bolt.
and it just sits there.
Apparently it confuses it enough that it doesn't go anywhere.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the emergency officials, you know, the fire department, the police, San Francisco Municipal Transit Authority, they're all pretty unhappy with the performance of these automated vehicles running around San Francisco. They're causing blockages, traffic blockages. This was during the Pride Parade the other week.
They just get stuck.
Two Waymo vehicles, you know, they got to a road closure and they didn't know what to do.
Oh, no.
And, you know, police directing traffic couldn't figure out how to communicate.
This has become a problem because they no longer, there's a unicorn. They no longer have safety drivers. So there's no human inside. And so I was wondering why I saw all those cones in San Francisco yesterday. Now I know they're waiting for a unicorn to show up. It's kind of the reverse, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like this.
I do. I think this is fantastic. Oh, boy. I feel bad for San Francisco.
What don't you like, Micah? The fact that people are doing these cones, or that these cars are driving around San Francisco.
It's not that the car. I guess I'm a bootlicker. I don't mind that the cars are driving around San Francisco. I do mind that they are placing because first of all, those traffic cones were in those places for a reason. I don't know what they are, but they were there for a reason. So to take them and put them somewhere else, you shouldn't. I'm a law follower. That's what I'm having a problem with.
I have a traffic cone.
Well, we don't know where people are getting the cones.
No, I have one in my yard.
That TikTok was very clearly suggesting just that people just go find one from somewhere.
Yeah, but I have one in my yard that's lying around if anybody wants to use it. If I see a Waymo, I'll run up and put it on.
If you take Leo's traffic cone, then I'm okay.
Somebody left it. I think somebody left it behind at some point.
But these are also like, I understand the sort of argument about these for-profit companies maybe taking jobs. I get that too.
It's not just jobs. They're tying up the streets.
Yes.
They're annoying.
But does making them stop in the road not also tie up the street?
Yeah, well, maybe it ties it up enough that these guys leave town. Stop doing it.
Well, I think that's what a lot of people are hoping for is that they'll go somewhere else. You know, or stop, you know, just stop testing on public roads until they get these systems working better. You know, it's, you know, for the foreseeable future, you know, this is not likely to cause any significant, job loss. In fact, you know, there's new jobs that are created because, you know, somebody still has to clean these things and, you know, charge them and do maintenance on these vehicles. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's different jobs.
I think what we saw in New York City with the advent of Uber was not a loss of taxi jobs so much as a complete congestion of the city.
Yes.
Because there were too many vehicles.
Happening in San Francisco. Okay. And this has long been one of the challenges that I've been talking about and writing about around deploying these vehicles. You know, if unregulated, these companies are just going to go and throw who knows how many of these vehicles out on the road, much as they did with scooters when we started seeing scooter sharing popping up a few years ago.
I was about to say that when that happened in San Francisco about 4 years ago, every city street was strewn with dead scooters, all the sidewalks.
Right. Oh, yeah,
it was a real hazard. Now, they kicked them out is what they ended up doing.
And I think, you know, what needs to happen, you know, before these things are widely deployed is we need to put some rules in place in cities. You know, there need to be some limits on how many of these vehicles can be deployed, where and when they can be deployed, that sort of thing. You know, much as we've done with, you know, it has always been done with taxis, you know, in any, I mean, going back
with medallions. You know, yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, and actually, you know, the whole idea of limiting the number of cabs is not a new concept. It actually goes back 400 years.
Yeah.
The, you know, long before we had cars, the original London, the term hack for a taxi goes back 400 years to the creation of the London Hackney cab, which was actually a carriage. It was a two-wheeled carriage, you know, with a driver on there. And, you know, these were used as cabs in London 400 years ago. And they had this problem then with, you know, too many of them causing congestion. And so the local officials put limits on how many of these could operate in the city at any time. And that has always been the case with taxis. And that needs to be the case with these vehicles, at least until such time as they are ubiquitous enough that people stop driving personal vehicles. And because otherwise we're just adding to the congestion, especially if these things aren't utilized enough. If ideally, you know, with these robo taxis, what happens is people get out of their own vehicles and they use these. And, you know, because most personally owned vehicles operate about 5% of the day. They might operate 1 to 2 hours a day. So they're idle 95% of the time.
The dream is sensible, which is to get rid of private car ownership.
Right. You have shared use of vehicles.
It's a nightmare.
And then
going into San Francisco right now. If I could beckon one of these vehicles and it would take me in, I'd not.
But as always with big tech transitions, there's this period of time where it's very disruptive and unpleasant for everyone.
The California Public Utilities Commission was supposed to have a meeting to vote on June 27th on giving permits to Waymo and Cruise to operate 24 hours a day throughout the entire city of San Francisco with paid passengers. They delayed that meeting. It's actually going to happen the end of next week. now.
Bring your traffic cones, kids.
Do you think
everybody go to the hearings?
Do you think they put traffic cones on the first taxi drivers back in the day over their heads whenever like the horse and buggy people had to switch for?
I somehow doubt that.
What was the protest?
But I'm sure
at that
there were
time?
Some other kinds of protests. Yeah.
I have mixed feelings about this because I do agree that the future of, you know, much reduced private car ownership and ubiquitous transport is a great future. I mean, we kind of dropped the ball on public transit with streetcars and buses and subways. That's a shame.
Yeah.
But maybe we can you know, get that back with self-driving vehicles. But
well, I think
we're not there yet. And it's a mess.
What we need is a mixed ecosystem because, you know, what you don't want is only robo-taxis.
Right.
You don't want only scooters. You don't want only buses.
No, that's a good point. You need it all.
You actually need it because they each have their strengths and weaknesses for different kinds of trips.
Yeah.
And so you need a mixed ecosystem of all of these that coordinate together, work together. You know, so, because what you want is maximum utilization of all of them.
Right.
And, you know, for mass transit, you know, you can't have buses and subways going everywhere in a city. But, you know, if you can have, you know, smaller vehicles like this and scooters that feed into the mass transit lines, you know, where you have the highest density. So you have more people using the buses and subways or trains being fed in, you know, for first mile and last mile by smaller vehicles, then you can actually start to have a real impact potentially on congestion and safety.
Well, I have mixed feelings. I do want an ID Buzz. I don't live in San Francisco, but my friends who do are not totally enamored of it. And I have to say, when you ride in one of these things, you might not share the enthusiasm the tech companies have for it. My friend Charlie said, Brock said, it's like a grandma driving.
They do tend to drive fairly conservatively because they're biased tentative. For safety.
Yeah, as they should be. Yeah.
I mean, they shouldn't be driving like a New York taxi driver.
No, but they also fail at strange positions and places.
And there's the problem.
Yeah. Now, isn't there supposed to be somebody monitoring this who can drive at home, you know? Yeah, but maybe they're just not doing a good job of that.
Or too many on the road or something.
I mean, there's also, in order to monitor it, you have to have a connection to the vehicle.
Oh.
And if you lose that connection, you know, as you're well aware, you know, especially in cities, you know, a lot of times you'll hit cellular dead zones. And if you don't have a reliable connection,
it's
possible that whoever is doing the monitoring is not able to see what happens when it gets stuck and is not able to provide it with guidance because they have remote guidance systems. So if the vehicle gets confused and doesn't know what to do, someone back in a control center is watching and they can step in and provide it some hints, you know, as to what to do next. You know, how if there's a new construction zone and the vehicle's not quite sure the safest way to get around that, somebody can step in and say, okay, you know, go around to the left. Make sure you pause and check. And gives it some hints and then lets it go. But if you lose the connectivity to the vehicle, then you can't do that. And that's where part of the problem
I share, Micah, your sympathy for the poor little AI. It's doing its best. It's doing its best. And you put a cone on its hood and it goes, I share that. My animus is entirely towards big tech, which just wants, you know, profits at all costs and take over the world and screw everybody else. And I think that we're starting to...
Well, I mean, that's capitalism. That's not just big tech. That's all capitalism.
But big tech's really good at it. And I think it's maybe time
to capitalize on capitalism
for the rest of us to say, no, that's not what we want. We like tech. Look, we're a tech channel. We love technology.
I'm going to buy some stock in traffic cone manufacturing.
That's a smart move.
Because I think Leo just got a bunch of people to buy traffic cones.
Sam Abul Samad, always a pleasure. When's the ID Buzz camper version coming? You said early next year?
Sometime in 2024. They haven't given an exact date, but there will be a camper version available. The pop-up, the traditional bus, VW bus
pop-up
camper will be available as an option on the ID Buzz at some stage. They haven't said exactly when, but sometime next year.
I was, and maybe sometime you can review this, BMW announced their i5 EV last month.
Yeah, they haven't had a chance to do the drives for that yet.
It's between that and the camper van for me. It's my capitalist side and my hippie side fighting. But I did put a deposit down on the i5. You tell me if I made a mistake, okay?
Well, I've driven the i7, and it's based on the same platform. It's basically smaller than the i7 and better looking, frankly. So I think if you were to get the i5, I've driven the i4 and the i7, which are smaller and larger than the i5.
Right.
And use a lot of the same hardware.
It's right in the middle.
So I don't think you'll be disappointed.
All right. The ID California is called, not the ID Buzz, the ID California.
It's the ID Buzz.
California edition.
The camper may be called the California.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Hey, thank you, Mr. Sam Abul Sam at Guidehouse Insights.
My pleasure.
Always a pleasure. We'll see you soon on Twit. Take care, my friend.
Bye. All right. Bye.
Sam joins us every month on the show. I am ready for another call. Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk to Chris. Chris is on the line. Let me push the buttons and all that stuff. Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. When you get into the zone, tell us where you're calling from.
Get in the zone.
Get in the
tech zone. Guy zone.
Can you do the head?
Which head?
Yeah, look at that. Damn. Holy cow.
All right, can you hear me now?
Hey, Chris, where are you calling from?
I'm in Aurora, Colorado.
Beautiful. Ooh, good to see you. Welcome.
Hello.
What's up in your life?
I don't have a question. It's been a long time since you've done Leo 6 rules. I think it's time that it gets pretty busy.
For setting up a Wi-Fi router, those 6 rules?
No, your general 6 rules.
6 rules for living?
No, it's Leo 6 rules. You did this many, many years ago.
Can you give me a hint?
Yeah. We say a lot of things.
Why don't I just summarize them?
You give me my rules, please.
All right. Let's see. Number one, do not open email attachments.
Oh, it's the security rules. Yes. And
that is self-explanatory at this point.
And what's interesting is that has held true from the day I said it, which was probably 20 years ago. Email attachments are now the number one way people get hacked.
And also, do not click links in email. Do not open up email that you do not know where they came from.
That's right. Still part of one?
No, actually, that's two.
Okay, so two is do not.
Part of one as well.
Mike is writing this down for next time.
Okay. That's fine. Mike can take notes. I don't care. And do not download files in places that you are not sure of.
That's right. That's true. Yep.
Let's see, update your OS regularly.
Yes.
That's still in effect today as it was back then. And that also applies to both Mac and Linux. My fear is that someday some disgruntled Linux programmers will make a nasty virus.
Well, that's gonna spread through you know what's actually a big problem, and Steve Gibson's been talking about this on our security show, Security Now, every Tuesday, is that the repositories like PyPI, where programmers get libraries for use in their programs, have never had any security on them and have later been compromised. So it's a real problem because an honest, hardworking, legitimate programmer might get a library that is malformed, not knowing it's a security hazard, and use it, thereby making his own software dangerous. So it is really a big problem. We have yet to come up with a good answer for this, but we've seen PyPI, which is a very big repository, compromised. The Node NPM repository has been compromised. It's not hard to do that. I guess you'd call that a supply chain attack. So I'd have to update those rules. The fundamental rule, and I think you know this, Chris, is a bad guy can't really infect your system unless he can get you to do something, run a program. So he either does that by compromising a program, by sending you a link that doesn't look like a program, or putting something on a website that runs a program. Now, if your operating system is insecure, it's possible to do a zero-click exploit, which is run a program on your phone or your computer that you didn't invite in and you didn't do anything. And those are the worst, scariest problems. And those are really down to the operating system not being fully secure. So that's why updating is so important. It, you know, really, there's two ways to get in. One, you invite them in. Don't invite the wrong one in. And two, you have a hole in your system that allows them in without you even doing anything. And so those really, those are the fundamentals you need to understand. Everything else revolves around those two things. You shouldn't download, you know, or open email attachments. You'd be careful what links you click, what software you use. I say don't install anything. Anytime you install anything on any platform, you open up a door, a potential door. Install the fewest possible apps. You know, that was definitely not in the original six. What else is in there, Chris?
All right, ready for number five?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, use a firewall. I think
I changed
everyone
that one.
Uses a firewall. Yeah. Matter of fact,
yeah, it's automatic.
Nokia phone has a firewall built into it. Also, I think use a VPN if you think it's necessary.
Yep. Those last two have changed over time. These rules are literally two decades old. Yeah. There used to be a rule, reboot your machine regularly. Some people even said...
Actually, that holds true with Windows. You should reboot your system at least twice a month.
Yeah.
If it's up running all the time.
And interestingly, your router, the FBI a couple of years ago sent out a notice saying everybody should reboot their routers because router exploits, some of them are zero-click exploits, will persist in RAM, not in firmware. So if you reboot your router, it clears out the exploit. And Mirai and I think some others actually just sat in RAM and could easily be cleared out.
Huh.
This is ChatGPT.
That's what it looks like.
Leo Laporte, a well-known tech broadcaster and founder of the Twit Network, has frequently emphasized the importance of security. While he has provided various tips and advice, there isn't a widely recognized six rules of security specifically attributed to Laporte. However, I can provide you with a general set of fundamental principles. As always, said with great confidence.
Yeah.
Yep. But actually, ChatGPT's not wrong. Use strong, unique passwords on every website.
That's a great.
We'd have to add that. That's changed over 20 years, hasn't it? Keep software up to date. Mention that. Enable two-factor. That's new, too. Absolutely. Use two-factor wherever you can. Be cautious of phishing attempts. That's the don't app open email attachments and unsolicited text messages, things like that. Now, I disagree with ChatGPT on this one. Use reputable security software. Install a reliable antivirus and anti-malware software in your devices.
You and I both,
not a fan.
Like, antivirus.
Again, and that comes down to that thing that everything you install potentially opens a problem. And because anti-malware software sits at a lower level, integrates more deeply. You know, you have to give it permission to integrate into the kernel and things like that. It actually opens a super highway into your system. And it's not a good idea.
It's such a common path for folks you need this antivirus. So
he adds regularly back. Is ChatGPT he? No. It regularly regularly back up your data, which of course, it's not even regular. You should have a backup plan that runs all the time.
What was six? Was six the VPN?
Yeah.
No. Six is different. I do not run as an administrator. At home, I run as an administrator. And I will say that if you're a Linux user, you absolutely do not want to run as an administrator because it gives you far too many too many privileges.
So six is always run as super user.
No,
I'm kidding.
Never.
I'm kidding.
Actually, all modern, that's changed a little bit too, because all modern operating systems do that. Windows was the last one with UAC. They finally said, because you run as administrator in most cases as a full user when you set up a Windows machine, but it still will warn you if you want to do something and ask for administrator authentication before you do something hazardous. So even Windows now does that. Macintosh, you run as administrator always, you know, that's the default. But again, same thing. It will say, wait, whoa, hey, hold on there. Do you really want to do that? And sometimes make you authenticate before you modify the system, for instance. Linux.
What about Linux?
It's really rare to set up a Linux system with you as super user. Almost always you create a user account. And then if you wish, and most Linux users, I do this, you can say, but I want to have administrative privileges using something called SUDO or SUDO or sudo sometimes people call it SUDO. You say, upgrade my account to administrator for this one command. You have to have permission to do that. You have to add yourself to the sudoers ring and all of that stuff. So most Linuxes, the way they're set up, that's built in. Debian's funny. It does not do that. But most Linuxes, you can use SUDO. You enter your password, but that's a way of saying, now, are you sure you want to do this? Because this is going to change something only an administrator could change. And you type your password to say okay with that. And I think that's pretty much what Windows and Mac are doing now. So I would say all three of the major operating systems do require some sort of authentication before you enhance your abilities. So yeah, the advice is still true. Don't run as administrator, but in reality, you're protected from yourself on modern operating systems.
And I have one more thing if you have time.
Yeah.
Has anyone tried to use a Brave search engine? I can't tell the difference between the results from Brave and from Bing. They seem about the same.
This is the dirty little secret of these third-party searches, is very often they're either licensing Google or Bing or both. But in theory, they hide your information from Google and Bing. You know, they're buying it wholesale and you're using it retail, and that information doesn't get back to Bing. Brave recently announced that they are going it on their own. So if you haven't tried it recently, it will be different now. They've stopped using Bing, they say, and they're using their own index. If you think about it, Chris, it takes a long time to build up a web index of all the billions and billions of sites out there. It takes a lot of effort, time, and money, maybe even years. So Google and Bing have this built-in advantage. So it makes sense if you're a new search engine, as Brave created a couple of years ago, you're gonna use Bing or Google initially. But Brave says, no, we really want to be fully private. We don't want to use Bing results, so we're going to go it on our own. And they did that not so long ago. Mm-hmm. So try it if you haven't tried it recently and see what the results are. It should look very different.
It seems about the same to me.
Does it? Well, maybe they've improved their, they've been spidering long enough that their search index is good now. It's best thing to do is do the same search on Bing and Brave and see how close it is. They claim, let me look at the news story and see when they did this. They claim Brave Search will no longer use Bing. And I do think it was recently. Yeah, this was in April. Brave Search removes last remnant of Bing from search results, achieving 100% independence. So they may have looked Bing-like in the past, but at least now, if you can trust them and they're not lying, and I don't think they are, it is now 100% Brave. They said even in the past, Bing was only about 7% of results.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I think I like Brave. You like the browser?
Yeah, I've been using it since it was in beta. I don't know how many years ago that was.
Yeah, it's based on Chromium, so it's a Chrome browser. But they're very privacy forward. They have built-in ad blocking and a lot of features. I think Brave's a very good browser. Total independence, they say, from Bing was a primary goal of Brave. In less than a year, the Brave Search global independence score rose from 87% to 93%, and now it's 100%. Well, wait a minute. They're intended to be 100%. I'm not sure.
We're trying to be 100%.
Yeah, by default, Brave Search users will now receive, this is again on April 27th, 100% of results from the Brave Index. Then there is a setting. So you might look in your search settings and see if you've turned off all Bing. They do say this independence does not come at the expense of quality. Over the past several months, the search team has drastically improved Brave Search's ability to answer nuanced long tail queries. Those are the tough ones. You know, if you search for Yahoo, you're going to get Yahoo.
Right.
Everybody's going to give you the same result. It's those smaller, lesser known sites, the long tail, as we call it, that's hard. For those who want it, and this is a setting in the browser, Google fallback mixing. It sounds like fun. I sometimes would like to try Google fallback mixing. Continue to be an option. Users continue to support the growth of the index by opting into the web discovery project and by submitting feedback. So keep using Brave. I admire what Brendan Eich and his team are doing. I don't really admire Brendan Eich. There's some questionable behaviors in the past. but I
don't know anything about him.
Yeah, better not to. But he used to be at Mozilla. I think Brave is a good browser, and I think they've done a good job. I'm still a Firefox guy, and the reason I use Firefox is I don't want the whole universe to become Chrome-based.
Yeah, everything else is Chromium, isn't it?
There's WebKit, Safari. Yep. There's Chromium, Google, and Chrome, and others. And there's Firefox's engine, and I've been very happy with Firefox.
Firefox's user base is shrinking fast.
Well, I'm staying.
Yeah, and Braves is going up because a lot of sites will not work unless you're using the Chromium engine.
Yeah, oftentimes, because Safari is my main browser, but I switch to Firefox when something's not working in Safari.
Well, if something does not work in Brave, I'll use Firefox.
Right.
If it does not use in Firefox, I use Edge. If it doesn't work in Edge, I just give up.
Chris, you're like the rest of us. I doubt many geeks, anyway, have fewer than several, three or four browsers on their computer.
Because I've been a geek since 1978.
I could tell.
So in a way, I'm contemporary with you.
Hey, it's great to talk to you. Thank you for joining us, Chris. I really appreciate it.
All right. And for the rules refresh.
And that for the great. Rules. There's actually a book I have. If I almost got up and ran and got it, but I won't do that. There's a book I have that was a really good book on security. I'll get it. Next time you're handling a call, I'll run and get it. We had intended to do a review of this very cool webcam today, but we're having a little trouble with the software. I don't know if the software is immature or I'm immature. I suspect it's the latter. but this is from Obsbot. They have released one of these before. It's a PTZ, pan tilt zoom camera for a webcam. Mm-hmm. And it's got a big sensor. It's got big capabilities and a really nice 4K output. This is the new Tiny 2 they just put out.
Tiny 2.
And I had pre-ordered it, got it the other day. So, but I'm going to defer my review until I can really give it full justice. But so far, I really like it. I compared it at home on my Mac to...
A summer's day.
No, I compared it on my MacBook Air to the MacBook Air camera, which is actually pretty good. It's a 1080p camera. And of course... Apple makes it very easy to use your iPhone as a camera.
Yep.
I would say the iPhone may still be slightly better, but it's a pain for me to
take
my iPhone and connect it up and all that.
Especially if you need to use it for something.
On the computer. Mm-hmm. So I do have a desktop that doesn't have a camera. The monitor doesn't have a camera. And I think this is what I'm going to start using. So
it's really nice looking too.
It's really, and it takes hand gestures. You could say, hi, it's me, zoom in, zoom out and all that stuff. And that was the part we couldn't get working on this Windows machine. So I don't want to demonstrate it without that working. It worked fine on the Mac, probably me. We'll get back to you. Maybe next week we'll do that review. What do you want to do next?
I think we should take one of the callers, the people who've called in to 888-724-2884.
I see one right here. Let me press the button and say, hello, wireless caller. Press *6 to unmute and introduce yourself and your city you're calling from. Yes, you.
Hey, Leo and Micah.
Hey, hello. What's your name?
This is Larry, Petaluma Larry. I was your very first caller.
I welcome you back, Petaluma Larry. Good to see you.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm calling you with an issue that I'm not happy about. I for the last few days have not been able to open my Adobe Lightroom Classic, and I've gone online and listened to all the nefarious advice, and I've been able to get. I was able to get it open a couple of times, but then I can't get my current catalog. I even went to my backups, and I'm not sure. I don't know if something's gotten corrupted, but apparently some people are having problems.
Yeah, Adobe. Adobe got corrupted by money. It's all about... No, I'm just kidding.
What are you using, a Windows machine or a Mac?
I'm going to let you handle this.
Yeah, I'm using a Windows desktop with... Windows 10.
Okay, and I'm guessing you already did the preferences reset.
Well, that's the first thing that the internet tried to do, and first few times I did it, nothing would happen, and then finally, I finally got it to come up, and I did do a reset.
Okay, so you were able to do the preferences reset, and then the next time you launched it, it was still just not opening?
I would not open. And when I would go into the task manager, it would show it as running and I have to end the task, but there was nothing coming up on the screen. It was not there.
Okay. Okay. I assume that you are keeping everything updated. So you checked to see if there were any updates for it. And honestly, that's probably what happened, is that an update came that caused the issue. So you did the whole hold down the alt and the shift keys and then, yeah, clicked on the shortcut. And then there was that window that popped up that said, are you sure you want to reset preferences?
Yes, I did all of that. Okay. In fact, I went through it a few times and finally I actually this morning went back and I uninstalled and reinstalled an earlier version, the 12.3, which is the version before the previous 12.4. And that I can get to come up if I do the shift and the alt key. Mm-hmm. But when it comes up and I click on my catalog, it comes up with some old catalog that has two photos in it. And I probably have, I don't know, thousands many, of many photos more. Now.
Yeah. I'm guessing what's happening there is the rest of your catalog, your library, has been updated to that newer version. And so the older version is not displaying the newer version properly. This is a tough one because there are so many different things that could be at the heart of this, especially that it's showing up that it's running. It's just not showing the window for you. Have you gone into your files and looked for the actual folder that is containing your Lightroom Classic catalog? Because yes, you're using the classic version, which means that you're not using the version in the cloud, so those photos are stored locally. Are you able to see those photo files kind of on their own, even though it's not loading?
Yes, I have gone into my backups the backups, and I found the catalog. But when I click on it, I get a window saying I can't open it because it's not a writable file. There's some strange message that comes up.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. Wait a minute. That's actually the clue right there. That sounds like a permissions issue. Windows can get into permissions problems pretty easily. You already said this, I'm sure, but you know, probably the best thing to do is uninstall Lightroom and wipe the folder out. And make sure when you uninstall it, you get all traces of it out. What I think you have is probably, and this can happen just kind of spontaneously, a cosmic ray can hit your hard drive, that the permissions on preferences have been changed so you don't have read and write privileges, or you might not have write privileges, but you have read privileges. And if it can't write to the preferences, it's going to really break it. It's going to say, well, but, you know, I can't. So or it can't read and write the light. This is another problem. I honestly want to blame Adobe because I hate them. It might be a license problem. They put a license file on the hard drive, right? That shows that you own it. Cause you're not logging into adobe.com to assert your ownership. This is an old version that uses the license file, I gather. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah. So that's what this is. This is copy protection. I'm almost certain that's what this is. And either the file's gotten corrupt, it can't read the file, or something.
Did you also try the other suggestion I'm seeing a lot of is removing that lrcat.lock file?
Oh, yeah. Any lock files will give you problems, too. Yeah.
I did not do that.
Okay. So we'll include a link in the show notes to this. But basically, and this is kind of what Leo's talking about, that lock that gets put on there, you can go in independently and remove that. And essentially what happens is when Lightroom restarts, then it just creates a new one.
Yeah, the lock file so you don't modify a file that it's currently using.
Exactly. So then it'll update that
stream.
So that would be my next suggestion for you. I assume you have not reached out to Adobe support yet. One of the good things about paying for a service is that the support is a little bit more.
How old is this Lightroom Classic?
Oh, I just updated it to 12.4. So,
oh, all right.
Before I went back to 12.3, it's current.
Yeah. So I would suggest at that point, if
this is devastating,
lock file doesn't work
because of course, as a photographer, all of your catalog is vital, right? That's the photos are still there, but exactly. all the stuff you've done, all of the organization, all the modification, all of that's stored in the Lightroom catalog. And if you can't open that catalog, you probably had it set to make backups, right?
Yeah, I have, and I've actually tried. I went into OneDrive and pulled down the backup.
Couldn't open
and
those
it won't
either.
Read that. Okay. The same thing happens, and I have a local backup on a different external drive, and that does the same thing.
Well, keep so those. In fact, at this point, yeah, keep those safe and secure. It's good they're on OneDrive so that Adobe can't modify it in any way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at the lock file. Something's gone on that it's not very good software. It's mostly written in Lua, and it's not very – it's kind of a little janky. I love Lightroom. I am off of it now because I just – Adobe's greed has just finally killed me. They make good stuff, though, and Lightroom was a very useful tool. I switched to Camera One, and then, you know, there's a lot of on the Mac anyway, there's a lot of third-party really nice tools like Pixelmator Photo and mm-hmm. Pixelmator Pro, Affinity Photo that I find I have all, gives me all the juice that I wanted to. The biggest thing with Lightroom is the digital asset management, the DAM management. And on Windows, there's no good, there really isn't much of a good choice on that. On the Mac, what I do now is I use Photos, Apple's Photos.
It's good.
That's my digital asset management. And then when I want to edit it, it allows me to open it, the photo, original photo in any editor. Mm-hmm. It's buggy too, by the way. I crash it all the time because I have 60,000 photos in it. But at least it doesn't do what Lightroom's doing to you now.
This is frustrating. So yes, I've just found another great page from Adobe that you may have seen an excerpt from, but I found the original page. It's got 8 to 10 different troubleshooting options that you can take, and it's direct from Adobe. It's not like just some forum post.
Good.
So between deleting the lock file is what I would suggest next. After that, go to this Adobe page. It has a lot of different troubleshooting options. And then third and last would be to actually reach out to Adobe, because as a paying customer, as opposed to whatever.
Yeah, at
we
least
get
you're
people
up to
who,
date. Sometimes
people call in asking for help with their Facebook account, and there's really not anything we can ever do with those.
Because Adobe obviously wants you to. I'm surprised they still do Classic, but they say, no, we're going to continue to do it. They want you to move to the CC version. They want you to move Creative Cloud. You know, their incentives are really for them to get you off of Lightroom Classic. But frankly, it's the only version of Lightroom I would even consider using. So I understand.
Is there paid support line number on their website?
I doubt there's a phone. It's going to be a email. Contact us email. They may have chat though.
Okay.
Try the lock files. I have high hopes.
Me too.
I think those are really what's going on. Hey, good luck.
Where do I look for the lock files?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Just look for .lock.
Yeah. If you don't want to wait for the show notes to get published, all you do is go to Google and type in Adobe Lightroom lock file.
And they'll tell you where they store
it. It'll
those.
Help you find it.
Yeah. And the license file may also be the issue. And I don't know what the way.
Yeah, I don't know about
that. I would think.
Be careful about that one.
Delete. Well, I'm not going to recommend it, but if it were me, I would delete it and try to reauthorize and see if that fixes it. All right, yeah, don't delete it. Move it to another folder where it can't find it. But okay. You still have it.
All right, gentlemen. Thank
Good luck.
You. I hope this works.
Best of luck. Best of luck.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Because as a photographer, everything's in Lightroom.
And it's kind of annoying that they're taking these photos and making them this special thing that you can't even get to unless Lightroom's working. Because that's the Photos app for Apple. You can get to
the original photos are there.
Even, yeah.
Yeah. You can. I mean, actually, that's a good point. Yeah. Once it's in the catalog. Ugh. This is the book I was mentioning. This came out quite a few years ago. It's by a guy named Mark Goodman, who was a law enforcement officer, 2015. He was a law enforcement officer. He got picked to be the forensics guy I think it was the Chicago Police Force, because he was the only guy who knew the codes for WordStar. He became futurist in residence with the FBI, senior advisor to Interpol, founder of the Future Crimes Institute, chair for policy, law, and ethics at Singularity University. Really great guy. I interviewed him on Triangulation many moons ago. And he had his rules, which is easier to remember because it's the acronym UPDATE. UPDATE. And I think my six rules probably, I remember when I interviewed him, I said, we have the same six rules. Update is update frequently is the U, of course. P, passwords, and that's the advice, you know, use a long, strong, unique password on every site. Download is the D, only from official sites, and I'd say I'd be highly skeptical software. Administrator, and that's the thing that's changed a little bit. That's the A. Turn off. This is the only one I disagreed with. He says, turn off your computer when you're not using it.
Oh, I don't need to do that.
And encrypt, which actually is quite smart. This predates the widespread use of two-factor authentication, so you're right. We should add that. Password managers, things like that. So, but this was a good book. It still is a good book. Future Crimes. Everything is connected. Everyone is vulnerable. And what we can do about it. So thank you, Mark Goodman, for being the inspiration for the six rules. And I guess they would change regularly. Chris is right. They're going to change because new things come along. All right, coming up next, we're going to go to Florida and talk to Wayne as we continue and Ask the Tech Guys. Wayne in Florida. Hey, Wayne, come on into the Stargate. What? Did we lose Wayne? Is he there? He has things. He has to move the gears. I want to get through a bunch of calls in the next half hour.
Oh, let's do it.
Can we do it? We'll Wayne, unmute. We see you, but you're
hi there.
There he is.
Wayne.
Where in Florida are you? Hey, Wayne.
I had to do a bunch of circling and stuff. Glad to get through.
Welcome. What can we do for you?
Well, I saw that the episode was 1982, and it kind of reminded me that's probably about when I started watching you on Tech TV.
It wasn't pretty that cool. long ago, but it feels like it. I know. Let me see. 82, I was working in San Jose at KLOK Radio. Moved in 84 to San Francisco, 87 KNBR. It was not till 1990. You might, although we did, Dvorak and I started talking computers in 92. So you might have heard those early days in the radio. And then, of course, Tech TV was 1998. But 25th anniversary of its launch was just a couple of months ago.
Wow.
Kind of. I am an ancient. Apparently, so are you. So yeah. Anyway.
Well, I met with you at CES about a dozen years ago.
Nice.
You had me on to show a little invention that I had that was a wraparound keyboard for a Xbox controller.
Wow.
I don't know if you remember that or not.
I don't. So what you're showing me looks like an Xbox controller. Is the keyboard on there?
Yes. I built it so that you had 10 buttons on
the bottom.
Oh,
look at that.
That's amazing.
2 buttons on top. And with those 10 buttons, you've got the entire QWERTY keyboard.
Oh, my gosh.
Cord keyboard.
So did you ever manufacture and sell it?
Well, the distributors wanted it to be a lot cheaper than I could even make it.
Yeah.
So we went and did a little KISS version of it. We came out with another product called the Decatext. It's a one-handed Bluetooth keyboard.
That's cool.
It's like a Rubik's Cube keyboard.
And, you know, with those 10 keys, you've got every letter, function, number, and symbol of the regular keyboard available. And so my question was, the new Vision Pro that's coming out with Apple, are they going to accept a Bluetooth keyboard?
Yes.
Yeah, that is one of the features. I imagine that at launch, it's going to be use the magic keyboard from Apple because they are.
But it's Bluetooth.
But it's Bluetooth. Exactly. Yeah. Now that I think about it, the reason why I was sort of delineating there is because
they also have a in the air keyboard.
They do. And the Meta Quest also lets you use a Bluetooth keyboard, but you have to do a special scanning thing to make it work. But now that I think about it, Apple's headset, part of it is that mixed reality. So you wouldn't need to worry about that.
I think it'll, you know, as far as we know, it'll work with any Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, by the way, but they're also
what I'm hoping.
Yeah, because that would be a new market.
I think it'll
for
be
you.
A killer, killer accessory for you. Don't have to stare at it and wait for it to do stuff. You can just tab and hit enter.
The disadvantage of it is that I have to learn a new QWERTY system. You know, I know how to type, And that's a kind of a steep hill for a lot of people, but
yeah, well, it's alphabetical. So
okay.
It's
okay.
Pretty simple. It's just a single press, A, B, C, D. Top is E.
So you could learn it pretty quick. Yeah.
E, A, I, J.
Yeah.
Then you hold the top buttons and press the other ones. So it's color coded. So the red ones work with the red letters. The blue one works with the blue letters. And then the whole color key is on here. Sorry, the camera's not very good. Not showing it real well.
You know, I was with my buddies at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View yesterday. And one of the things we saw was the Xerox Alto, and it was designed based on, the mother of all demos with Douglas Engelbart. It was the first computer that had a mouse, but it also had a cording keyboard, and there was a little cording. It looked like four piano keys. A little cording device next to it. You're familiar with this. And my friends Brock and Charlie said, "What's that?" I said, "I think that's a cording keyboard." The earliest days of these were the pioneers of the graphical user interface. They really thought that we would want a cording keyboard. And I guess it just never really took off for some reason. Here's a picture of
Douglas Adams of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy said that he thought that the time had come that the QWERTY keyboard is no longer good and that system designers need to come up with something better about how people hold devices and the fit and feel.
A court reporters don't use a regular keyboard. Right. They use QWERTY keyboards because they can't otherwise keep up with the speech. Mm-hmm. And so it is out there and it's learnable, obviously. And it is much faster. It is a much better way to type. Wish you luck. I think it's a great idea.
I'm also working on a virtual version called MicroText, TXT, MicroText. And you can look that up.
Something like an app?
I agree with you. I mean, I'm so used to the QWERTY, as we all are. It's obviously not ideal, and it's really not ideal on a smartphone where it's, the size of your, not even the size of your pinky.
Right.
I cannot type to save my life on a smartphone. I mean, autocorrect helps
a little bit.
That's
the only reason that I can type as I can.
Yeah.
Some of your texts. Yeah, you can't type.
Steve Martin told me that all the young comics never fix their typos in text. They think it's funny. So there's a trend. True.
It's true, because then I always will comment on the typos that you make. So it is fun.
It is fun. And you know what I mean, usually.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes
you can understand what the person's saying. I was told, I remember in middle school when I learned how to type, we had the typist, and the keyboard teacher, as she was called, told us that the reason that the QWERTY keyboard came along was because the typewriter was set up in the alphabet style, and the typists were typing so fast that they would jam the typewriter. I don't know if it's true, an apocryphal story.
Not actually.
I heard that story too, but I think it's
apocryphal. I always liked that.
It's a great story. Yeah.
I remember as a kid going, that seems unfair. They should just fix the machines.
If you look at the original patent, it's the QWERTY design from 1869.
Wow.
So
where did he come up with it? Why is it QWERTYUIOP at the top row? Why? How did that come about? I wonder.
A couple of theories on it. He wanted the letters for the word typewriter, the name of his device, on the top row.
Are you kidding me?
So all of the letters
me?
The typewriter are there.
They are.
That's terrible. That's worse than the jamming story.
He also was a typesetter, so he wanted to try to keep blocks of type where he felt his target market was.
Right.
And so that's kind of went into the influence. Plus, he did originally line it up as two rows alphabetically, but the post-Civil War era technology just, he couldn't make that work with the hammers.
Right.
So he reduced it to three rows and then made it so that less popular letters were in top on top. So A is underneath Q and W, because you're not going to use Q and W very often.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so he tried to maximize it. He wanted to try to get a little bit of left hand, right hand action in there so that there was a little bit more space
and that's,
between the
headers. That actually is pretty true. You don't, when you touch type, it's pretty balanced, yeah, right? You yeah. don't, one hand doesn't feel like it's working harder than the other.
I'm not writing a bunch of words with just the right side. Yeah.
Well, and then Dvorak came out in the 30s and he put all of the vowels on the left hand and the most prominent consonants on the right hand so that you'd do actually more common words on the home row.
There is, I will ask Glenn Fleischman because his book he did with Marchin, which is called Shift Happens. In fact, my copy should be coming pretty soon. He has a whole chapter. It's a book all about keyboards. And he has a whole chapter on QWERTY and Dvorak myths and legends. So I think he's probably done the deep research into why keyboards are the way they are. This book is just a book about keyboards. It's really, I can't wait to get my copy. I will definitely ask Glenn next time he's on one of our shows. Hey,
excellent.
Congratulations. I'm glad you've kept the prototype and you kept it going and good luck. Maybe the Vision Pro will be the breakthrough you need.
Actually, the Decatext won an R&D 100 award.
Nice.
Nice.
In 2017.
Congratulations.
And remind us again of the software version.
Software. Oh, okay. It's a Microtext, MICROTXT.
Excellent.
And it's, it basically reduces it to only 5 zones that you swipe on. And, that gives you the ability to type most things. Part of the idea with that is to reduce it enough so that you could utilize your tongue on a device for people that don't have the ability to move their arms and legs.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's my, and also to be able to type on a watch.
On my watch.
And on a watch would be very useful.
When I had both my hands busy and I just needed one tap.
I think the world's just catching up with you. That's all.
Yeah, it just took a little while longer. Yeah. Exactly.
Hey, a pleasure talking to you again.
The websites and this is the Decatext, DECATXT.
DECATEXT. Thank you for calling.
TXT.
No E.
Yeah, like Tumblr.
No E. In either Decatext or Microtext.
Pleasure talking to you.
Branding for you.
Yeah. Have a great day. Take care. That's fun. It's really fun. I've been doing this long enough now that you're starting to meet people again that you met years ago.
Yeah.
Back in the good old days. Paul Thurrott writing an interesting article that I'm just being told about in the IRC. Evernote is moving its entire operation out of the U.S.
What?
And I think a lot of people who, like me, were big fans of Evernote in the day. Some people haven't moved off of it. A lot of us have. And there are a lot of great,
I don't use Evernote.
Choices now. But for people who are on Evernote, Paul says
where are they moving
there's
to?
There's some fear of closure. They laid off most of their staff. So that is a little bit scary. It's been a hard road for Evernote because initially they were, was it always subscription? I feel like it wasn't in the early days.
Yeah, probably very early.
Yeah.
It was not.
129 Evernote staffers laid off. They're based in Milan, the Bending Spoons company that bought them.
I just learned about the magician that did the Bending Spoons thing.
Uri Geller.
That article.
Yeah.
There was a great article about him.
It was a fake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Needless to say, you can't bend spoons with your mind. All right. Let's get another call on the air coming up in just a bit. Reed is on the line. Hello, Reed. Welcome. Where are you calling from?
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. Hi, Reed.
I'm calling from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Great to see you. Thanks for calling.
Great to be on. Long
now, wait a minute. Now, did you just run a marathon? Is that what 26.2 is?
Well, this is part of the theme of my call. I did recently. The Flying Pig here in Cincinnati is the first Sunday in May. So I did run that.
Nice.
A few weeks back. My call is connected to this topic of fitness and exercise. I'm an Apple Watch enthusiast.
As are we.
And I travel a lot.
Yep.
I know both of you are. My family and I are headed out to Southeast Asia.
Okay.
For a trip here, actually in a week.
Oh, I'm so jealous. Where are you going?
We'll be flying into Singapore.
Oh, I love Singapore.
For a couple of days and then headed over to Siem Reap in Cambodia, where we'll see Angkor Wat.
Oh.
And then into Thailand, an island called Koh Samui for a few days, and then Bangkok. And
wow.
Coming home.
Bucket list
items. A couple weeks.
Have you been before?
Never been. I have no idea what we're, you know, this will be
what a great
an adventure for all of us. I've got teenage kids, 18 and 15, so it'll be a big adventure for them as well.
Yeah. My dad got me into traveling, and I'm forever grateful because it's one of the best things to do. Just enjoy it so much. So, how can we help you? You've got your watch, your fitness guy. What was your time in the Flying Pig, by the way?
Well, this year's Flying Pig was kind of a crazy event. We had a huge storm that morning. It kind of made, I think the Washington Post had a story about it. There was some controversy over whether the race should have been canceled. There was lightning, and I mean, it was wild.
Oh, wow.
So I got routed off the course at about mile 5 and stuck in a parking garage for about 10, 15 minutes.
Oh, well, that kind
of
hurts.
I'll claim a time of a little over 4 hours if I set aside standing in a parking garage, which gave me COVID a couple days later.
What a winner.
You can, you know what? I'll give you an extra 30 minutes off if you want to take it.
Extra points. So it was quite a race this last year.
It's good they got you indoors if the lightning was coming. I think that's probably.
They said it was later. They characterized it as a discretionary pause that you know, because you can't pause a marathon. You either pull it, take it off, cancel it completely. So some people kept running, but I kind of went into the garage anyway.
I think you were smart. Look at the water that they were
running
through.
How did you find this?
That is not a good way to run a marathon. I'll tell you. Unless your feet are
hot. I love that you found that. I was a little bit ahead of, so that group would have been a later starting. And so I got they are in Kentucky and they're going to run back across the bridge just in a second. And they got swept up in really the worst of the deluge there. And as they were doing that, that's about the time I was standing in a parking garage back in downtown on the other side of the bridge.
It's Louisville to Cincinnati. Is that the race?
No, Cincinnati is sort of the Cincinnati region is Northern Kentucky, which is Newport and Covington.
Right.
If you fly into the Cincinnati airport, you're flying into Kentucky.
Right.
Right. So it's just goes this little, there's bridges across the Ohio River and it goes across those bridges into Covington and then back across into downtown Cincinnati. Louisville's about, I don't know, 90, 100 miles.
Yeah. It'd be a beautiful race though, wouldn't it?
It's fun. It's a very hilly city. So it's a challenging race in that way, but it's a good course.
Nice.
So I'm super into my closing my rings, right? that's a big deal for me. And I'm on a long streak of like 4.5 years.
There are three rings. You close your rings if you get the proper amount of exercise, activity, and standing in one day. Okay.
Right. So you may be able to anticipate my question here. If you're imagining I'm going to Southeast Asia, I want to close my rings every day and I want to maintain my streak.
You're going to get a lot of walking in. I think that's pretty safe.
I'm going to lose a day.
Yeah.
I'm going to lose a day.
International dateline problems.
Yeah.
You're
going to gain that day back in the other direction.
I gain it back at the other end, but like I can't quite get my mind around.
Yeah.
I land, that day is gone. Unless I don't even know if exercising on the plane gets me anywhere.
That's a great question.
There is a way to, and I think it's in the health app, you can essentially...
You don't change your time zone maybe, right?
Well, no, what I was going to say is you cheat.
Here's a guy on Reddit said, I lost a 390-day streak due to a business trip to Japan.
There you go, right?
OMG. What's your streak?
It's like 1,588 days.
Yeah, you should be able to add a run. You know, the thing is, I don't know how you would add stand data from a third-party app. Because, you could easily get the exercise and the move done by just using a third-party app, and you just would hit, like, the plus button and log that you did an exercise. And then you, in your heart, if you felt like you needed to make it up, you'd just do that exercise later,
Run extra, I'll handle the conscience part of it.
But as far... Maybe you need to stand for, like, on the...
I guess that's where I'm also like confused. So like if I can, sometimes I'll be on a flight and I'll shake my wrist, you know,
this is the problem. You know, I have the same problem because like if I row one day without my watch, I feel like it didn't count.
Right.
Like, but of course it counted.
Was watching. So
Of course it counted. But and this is as much about like, maybe this is a sign that I just need to believe in my own, fitness capabilities and not rely on the streak on the watch, but you know, you get caught up.
But at the same time, this has been gamified for you to this level. Now you said you read something. I am curious.
There are workarounds.
I've Googled it. I came across a post that was on the Apple support site. I don't know if it was 4 or 5 years old. This guy had really thought through it. He didn't really come up with a solution, and not a single person replied to his post.
Oh.
And I think what he came up with was, what if I put it on airplane mode and left it on that for the entire trip? But that, then you're like off.
And this is because of
a solution.
The you can shift, right? Manually add a workout.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah.
So I think.
Right. So Mike is saying you could do that, but what about the stand? You know, does that do anything for the stand hour?
That's the part.
Oh, if you. Okay. So I do know this. And don't ask me how I know this, but your stand will change if you set your exercise and activity to zero. Your stand will adjust. Let me see. I'm on a Reddit thread that says there are hacks. My solution was to keep my phone watch in my home time zone the whole time. Obviously, that's ideal.
Yeah.
Set your time back to the day. Do stuff that day.
Right.
Or install an app that records activity and then records it for that day. Go into your phone, set the time.
So like a Strava or some like a third party app.
Third party app. Go into your phone, set the time and date for the 10th, then close your rings that day, then put it back to normal. In other words, you'd have to close your rings twice in one day.
Right, right.
And then put it in airplane mode. A lot of people say streaks should have rest days, right? You should have a way. Because what happens?
Absolutely. And this is actually a big issue, I think, with the Apple Watch and the way it's great to get people going once you're really a serious runner or whatever.
Absolutely. Because it gives you incentive to do this every day.
And if you're a serious runner, you look around and there aren't many Apple Watches being worn.
No, they all are Garmin's. Yeah.
It's Garmin country.
Yeah.
And Garmin does all that stuff. Right. But you know, I like the Apple Watch and I went to the Ultra because I love
my Ultra.
Really is competing at that level.
But my marathon time is about 78 hours, so I'm not the guy to ask on that one.
I think I may have something. I'm doing one more test here.
He's messing with his watch.
Yes. So let me see if this works. So someone suggested that you could essentially do a 1 minute workout, and in doing a 1 minute workout that you kind of add, what it'll do is think of it as if you were standing during that time.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's how you hack the stand.
Here's how if you do that workout kind of retroactively, it'll assume you've been standing.
So if you go into the health app, you choose browse, you tap on activity, you'll find your workouts page. And then at the top right, there's the add data button. You tap add data, you change the activity type. This is important. This is the most important thing.
Okay.
You change the activity type to other, and then under calories, you can leave that blank. On the start and end, you just need to put a minute between the two. And so what you would do is from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m., you would have, or not, sorry, 9 a.m. to 9:01 a.m., you'd have one. 10 a.m. to 10:01 a.m., you'd have one. And those, because remember, it's once per hour that you're supposed to stand for 12 hours of the day. Once you've added those, that should then add that to your rings and you would get those.
Okay.
We will also put in the show notes, Mike B has sent us a Mac Rumors thread where
terrific. Okay.
Yeah. It's a point by point to start. My phone is set to automatically set time based on location. On the day of the 4th, I fill my activity ring before leaving home for the airport. My watch registers the activity for the day on the 4th based on Eastern time. However, on arriving, then I turn date and time on to manual, set it to Australia, thereby getting my watch and phone to think it's on the 5th. I fill my activity ring for the 5th by doing a workout from the airport during my layover. I then continue on to Australia. I land in Australia on the 6th, hit the gym that day, then I can switch my phone back to automatic. So in other words, he does a double workout.
I feel like I found this guy's post, but if you'll put it on the show notes, I'll.
Yeah.
But see, for people who think we're nuts, This is really why the Apple Watch helps people with their fitness, because you get compulsive saying, I got to close my rings. I got to close my rings. And it gives you awards and stuff. But they need to put in a pause button.
That's what there's been so many advocates for that they say, let's make this more
because
human.
Even a professional athlete, even Arnold Schwarzenegger takes a rest day once in a while, right?
Well, the other thing the watch does, if you really get into it, is the monthly challenges, which get progressively more challenging to the point where it's like, Apple, are you just trying to kill me?
Yeah.
Like, I can't, you know.
I'm at the point where it's happy if I exercise four times a month. It says, oh, good for you, fatso.
They've gotten a little milder with the monthly challenges, but they can be brutal. And it doesn't give you, you know, much, at least the monthly challenges are sort of cumulative over the month.
I hope
Apple's
listening.
Whereas your daily rings are just like, they're relentless. I'm with you. You know?
I am totally with you on this. You're absolutely right. Well, I'm sorry.
But you can change your rings. You could, if I wanted to have a rest day, I could say for that day, I'll change my move ring.
You know, I
think that's kind of the answer.
You know, in your heart,
yeah,
you're doing what's right for you.
I do,
but,
Leo.
But we get compulsive about this. And there are people saying, after my streak was broke, I lost all interest. You know, I never.
This is the thing. It's
I'll never do it again. And it is very beneficial. Yeah. I don't know what the answer is.
There's this. And then my wife is concerned about maintaining her Wordle streak. So we'll have to figure that out.
That's a challenge.
As well.
Well, how does Wordle handle the international dateline? That's a good question.
But I can save that. For
how long
Google
is your
anymore.
Wife's Wordle streak?
Jen, what's your Wordle streak?
So cute.
565.
Holy moly. Ooh. That's like pretty almost 2 years. Huh? That's incredible.
Yeah.
Good for her. She's never not
it's
gotten
something that runs in the house.
The answer in six tries on Wordle. She's never missed. Like, I can't.
That
get
is
it.
Correct.
Wow.
That is correct.
Wow.
And she doesn't cheat. She uses fun words every day, whatever she's got going on. She'll start with some.
Really? She doesn't have a standard
word. So she doesn't
word?
Do that, like, you know.
Oh, I have
that,
tears.
That
I use tears.
Optimal
every
starting
time.
Word.
Yeah, no, I have a good
do.
Starting word. But there was a couple of days ago, it was. I had OTEL, and it could be too many different things. I had hotel, I had motel, I had rotel and fotel, and finally I got it. But it was on the sixth guess, so my streak is unbroken.
Well, I'll email you guys back. I'll let you know.
Yeah, do and have a wonderful trip. I think this sounds great.
Thank you.
Regardless of however it goes, please have a good trip.
I will not let this ruin the trip one way or the other.
But I did. I double checked, and it did update my stand ring. So.
Okay, terrific.
I've been
Thank
sitting
you for
in this chair.
That.
And he hasn't stood up once.
And I haven't stood up.
Yeah, I think that's the
that's
hack.
A great.
It assumes that you've been standing if you've been exercising.
If you've been exercising, you've been standing. Yeah. So.
Good. Good. Have All a great right. trip. Great to talk to you.
Likewise. Thanks, guys.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. This is fun. We're having fun today.
Yeah, it's fun.
I like getting more calls in, if possible. I think we have time for one more
Let's
now.
Let's take one more
Do you
call.
Want to do a phone number?
Why not? Yeah, that 888-724-2884. We appreciate you for calling in.
How do I know if it's a phone number?
It'll have a phone icon on it.
Or the letters are uppercase.
There's a John H. is all
Yes, we're going to do John. Yeah.
All right.
Let's go. John, coming up in just a bit as you're watching Ask the Tech Guys. *6, John. I use tears because I like the S at the end. I like to get that. Audio is another good one. I want to get the vowels in. ETAIONSHRDLE.
I always try to get E in there since it's the most common letter.
Yeah, that's why I like tears. I get two vowels.
Yeah, that's
I get
good.
An S. T is good.
The only thing is I read that
R is good.
It's never a plural.
Okay.
Hey, there you are.
The answer
Hi,
is
Hi, John.
Hello there.
Where are you
Hi,
calling?
How are you folks?
We're great. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Santa Clara.
All righty.
And what I wanted to do was make a few points. I'm a retired academic librarian. I still work part-time at the Anza College Library, you know, in Cupertino.
Librarians are kings and queens. I love librarians. Yeah. All right.
The interesting thing, though, I'm a person who's owned a Trash 80, started out, used to go to West Coast Computer Fairs.
Oh, yeah, that was a great
somewhere
fair.
Along the line.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to do is make 3 points about searching the internet. And this is from a librarian who's been teaching online research since 1997.
Nice.
And people complain about Google because they think that the some of the pages that Google is feeding to you as a result of your search is because they want to put in the hierarchy those kinds of things that they may be able to make money off of.
Yeah, why does YouTube always show up at the top of my videos, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an example. And the thing about it is that Google still has the largest database of web pages, words, images, whatever. I read an estimate about a year or so ago, 10 to 20 trillion words.
Wow.
In Google's database.
Wow.
So it does give you the best tool in terms of the total amount of information on its database that you can search for. The problem is learning how to search it properly. When I teach orientations, I've taught online research at Foothill College and actually several other colleges, junior colleges in the Bay Area, that I also taught online research for the School of Library and Information Science at San Jose State.
I just want to say all three colleges are within the ring of influence of Apple. De Anza's just around the corner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Foothill's just around the corner. So you're right there in the heart of Silicon Valley there. And still people don't know how to use Google. What are your top Google search tips? Help us be better at Googling.
The single most important search tip is using Google Advanced Search and using Google Scholar. Both of those tools can give you sophisticated ways of doing searching. You remember Booleans?
Yeah.
Booleans are something that most people don't know
and
about.
But that,
or not. Right. But Google also has a proximity search operation that most people do not know. And that is about. If you put in one word and type the word about in capital letters and open paren and say, put a number, say 3 or 5, close paren, and then a word after that, it will search for those two words in that proximity in either direction.
Oh, my goodness.
That proximity searching is great. Now, I mean, I started out teaching, databases in the colleges like EBSCO, like Dialog. Do you remember Dialog?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be on El Camino in Palo Alto or Mountain View.
Yeah. We were near down your way. We're at the Computer History Museum. We saw LexisNexis terminal. It was kind of cool to see that. Yeah. Yeah.
And I taught LexisNexis. I taught the medical databases. I taught just about everything in terms of major databases.
Michael doesn't remember those days. Those days are long.
No, looking at him.
It's kind of amazing though, isn't it? It's amazing, John. I mean, here we have Google, which kind of combines all of those tools. I love Google. I love it that you mentioned Google Scholar because I think a lot of people don't know about that. What is Google Scholar?
Well, Google Scholar is just a subset of the entire Google database, but it's oriented towards academic sources that are on like .org or .gov or .edu, things like that.
Plus, it has a case law search, which is really fantastic. You don't need to have a very expensive Westlaw subscription to search case law. So, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but most colleges provide you with an access to LexisNexis.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. De Anza College does, San Jose State, Foothill. So, Westlaw is a wonderful database,
but expensive.
A second point, I really but very expensive.
Very expensive. Yes. Yeah, it's kind of cool the that we. I mean, who would have thought? I think you're roughly my age. Who would have thought in our youth when we went to college and I was writing papers on a typewriter and had to go to the library and go to a card catalog and do research from books to support my papers, who would have thought all of this would be at our fingertips, not just on our desktops, but literally in our pockets instantaneously. What a revolution in information it is.
back when I was in high school, I was graduated in 64. I was doing for a senior biology project other compounds that could mimic or have similar capabilities to the oxygen, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, you know, ones that are the basis of all life.
Yeah.
And what I needed was a book on chlorine-fluorine compounds, which have a similar degree of complexity. And my librarian had to get the book, request the book.
An interlibrary loan. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, from UC Berkeley.
And it takes a couple of days. And, oh, my gosh. It took you days to get that.
Sometimes weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember, sometimes it took weeks to get that from another place.
That's right.
Second point I want to make about searching is that, honestly, from a librarian's experience teaching online research, most people are lousy at searching.
Yeah.
Thank God for the sophisticated natural language parsing algorithms that Google's and the other databases use.
There came a time
that really helped.
I used to always promote the idea of using Booleans and quotes to get exact searches and cite colon and all these things. And it got to a point where Google got so good at guessing what you were looking for that I stopped talking about that, because unless you really have a specific search that's, you know, difficult, most of the time Google's pretty good at just going, yeah, you might, I know what you mean. You nitwit. Here it is.
It gets better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's nice to have those tools.
A little help.
Yeah. It's very nice to have those tools.
The one thing is the AI, though, has not been very much help. I have seen students try to use ChatGPT or Bard or things like that to search. And honestly, the quality of searching they're doing is lousy.
Yeah.
And that's because there are four things that I think are important for students or anybody using doing online searching or any kind of database searching.
I'm writing
that's
it down.
One, it's one. A creative thing.
Yes.
One, it's a creative thing. You've got to be creative. It's not just a scientific, logical, organized thing. But on the other hand, you also have to have a knowledge of the search tools, how each works, what their capabilities are. And that's why I always taught Google Scholar when people were doing web searching.
Yeah, that's a really good
three, one. Yeah. Three, experiment. This goes along with creativity, that you need to experiment and try things that if it didn't work one way, try something else. You've got to be experimental when you approach a good search.
I agree.
And the final quality is understanding, thinking about the probable language and words that are being used in what they're searching for. So as an example, a veterinary document about taking care of cats would use different language than somebody who has a website, you know, their favorite cats and all of that kind of stuff.
You almost, have to put yourself in the mindset of the site you're trying to find so that you know how to search for it. Yeah, I think that's really good advice.
Well, I mean, those are the things that I would teach in a class.
This is why we have to cherish librarians, because this has been the discipline since, you know, the Library of Alexandria, which was, how do you find information in a pile of information? How do you find the thing that you're looking for? And that's such a useful skill, even in today's digital age. John, I'm so glad you called.
Yes, thank you so much.
No, thank you, folks, for this program and for 20 years. Is 20 years of Twit now?
Almost, yeah. We started in 2005, so it'll be 20 years in a couple of years, 18 years, yeah. Hard to believe. Isn't that amazing?
I really appreciate it.
We've grown up together. John, I look forward to hearing
other people onto it as well.
Yeah, good. Hey, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I look forward to hearing from you more. I really appreciate your knowledge.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, John. Take care. Yeah. Of course, one way you could support what we're doing, and it's becoming more and more important, and I really got to put a plug in for Club Twit.
Absolutely.
Because honestly, at this point, I hate to say it, we're at break even. That means we can keep doing what we're doing as long as one advertiser doesn't drop out or, you know, as long as one show doesn't start losing audience. And I don't like to be on that knife's edge of breaking even.
None of us here do.
Yeah, you don't like it either, do you?
No.
Because, you know, we don't have deep pockets. We don't have venture capitalists. All we have is you, our community. We would love, you know, look, break even just means that I don't get paid. That's fine. I can live with that. I just don't want to drop below that point. I would love to get everybody who listens to these shows, people like John who appreciate it, people like you who just heard John and said that was good information. If you could just spare $7, look, if you can't, I understand. People sometimes say, do you have a senior discount? I say, yeah, it's free. Then we will continue to offer all the things we do, like this show, ad supported for as long as we can for free. When advertising dollars go away, and they are going away, it's not just us, across the industry, we have to turn to you. $7 a month, I think, is a very good deal. It's one of the lowest costs mm-hmm. out there for a subscription. You get ad-free versions of everything we do. You get shows we don't put out anywhere else. Micah does Hands on Macintosh. Paul Thurrott does Hands on Windows. We have the Untitled Linux Show with Jonathan Bennett. We have the Giz Fizz with Dick DiBartolo every Wednesday night. I think we do a lot of great programming with the help of our community manager, Ant Pruitt. You're helping pay his salary as well. Ant puts together some great programs. We also have, you know, Twit Bits and other stuff that doesn't appear in the podcasts on the Twit Plus feed. We also have the Discord, which is, you know, for some, I know not, by the way, only, I would say about 60% of people who join the club actually spend time in the Discord. But it is a great community for chatting about all kinds of geek subjects. I just love it. It's our social network. We have the free social networks, the Mastodon at twit.social, the discourse forums at twit.community, yes. But this is the one where, you know, there's a little velvet rope in front. And that makes it a lot. I have to say, the people who support the club, who are in the club, are great people. So it's a wonderful place to hang. I think for $7 a month, you're getting an awful lot. But more important than anything else, you're getting in your heart the knowledge.
Absolutely.
That you're keeping this thing going. And to, you know, look, I can afford to retire. I don't have to work. Micah cannot.
Exactly. Please.
So some of us.
My dogs need to eat.
It's not going
to
kill me if Twit had to fold. But I think it might kill some other people, might really bother them. It might bother you. This is how you keep it from happening. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit and join the club. More than ever, this is absolutely vital for our continuation. And as I said, you know, it's not for me you're doing this. It's for the content. So thank you in advance. And a big hearty thanks to all the current club members. I think it's 8 or 9,000 strong right now. It's really good. The thing is, okay, one more thing. 700,000 people listen to our shows every month.
Mm-hmm.
That's 700,000 unique individuals. And we only have 8 or 9,000 members. I would love to get to 10%. If we got to 10%, we wouldn't need advertising. We'd never have to worry again. So if 1 in 10, maybe that's you, subscribe. Everything's good. I'm sorry. I've sounded like a TV preacher at this point.
But you never want to send them miracle water. So.
No miracle water. I will pray for you, Howard. Hey, thank you, everybody. We're done, right? We're out of time. We've got a big Twit coming up. I imagine we'll be talking a little bit about Threads, among other tech news. This Evernote story is concerning somewhat. That's coming up in just a little bit. We got to give the hardworking studio team time to reset the studio. So I think Micah and I will decamp.
We shall.
For the week. Come back next. We do this every Sunday, 11 a.m. We show up at 11 a.m. The show's about 11:15. Anyway, we turn on the stream around 11 a.m. Yes. And to 1:30 p.m. That's Pacific time. So that'd be 2 to 4:30 East Coast time. We kick things off around 1800 UTC. You can figure out what time that is in your locality. You can watch or listen live at live.twit.tv. I strongly encourage you to join, you know, the team tech guys by going into our IRC. All you need is a browser, irc.twit.tv. You can chat with us there. That's open to everyone. Of course, the Discord is also open to Club Twit members. That chat room is very helpful. As you see during the show, we get a lot of links, a lot of ideas, a lot of suggestions. You really are a big part of the answers that we can give. So we really appreciate it when you join us in the chat room. After the fact, you can watch the show or listen on demand, because it's a podcast, at twit.tv/ATG. That's the website. All the shows are there, going back to episode one, I think. Or maybe not. We couldn't get one or two or three. I think four. Anyway, it goes back
quite
2004. It's quite an archive. And of course, the most recent, 1982. Wow. That's at twit.tv/ATG. You can also subscribe. There's a podcast feed. Best thing to do is find your favorite podcast client and subscribe to this and all of the Twit shows. That way you'll get them automatically. You can listen whenever you want. There's also a YouTube channel dedicated, which is a good way to share. I apologize to Micah and Brian and Strawn and Larry and all the people we didn't get to. But we'll be back next week, and I hope you'll call back then, and we'll get to you as well. We don't like to rush.
Exactly.
I want to give everybody fair time.
We should. Yeah. And also remember that if you don't have the time to join us live, you can always call during the week and leave that voicemail.
That's right.
888-724-2884.
Or email audio. Video is also welcome, as well as text, atg@twit.tv. Mike will be back with iOS Today on Tuesday with Rosemary Orchard. You can ask Rosemary for a tip on that thing that I forgot what it was, but she will have some answers. And do you remember what it was?
It was cropping photos out of
it. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, on Thursday with Tech News Weekly and right here on Sundays for Ask the Tech Guy. I'm Leo Laporte. I will be back in about 5 minutes. Thank you for joining us, everybody. Have a great week. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You want to hear about the latest news happening in the tech world from the people who write the article, sometimes from the people who are actually making the news? Well, we got a show for you here at twit.tv. It's called Tech News Weekly. Me, Jason Howell, and my co-host Micah Sargent, we talk with some amazing people each and every Thursday on Tech News Weekly, and we share a little bit of our own insights in each of us bringing a story of the week. That's at twit.tv/TNW. Subscribe right now.